Welcome to MCH Bridges, where we lift up innovative ideas and inspiring stories from people in the maternal and child health field. In today's episode, we're going to dive into Tennessee and Puerto Rico's emergency preparedness and response journey over these challenging past few years.
Hi, I'm your guest host for today, Nia Sutton, Program Manager for Emergency Preparedness and Response on AmCHIP's Workforce Development and Capacity Building Team. In the times we live in, we are constantly facing all sorts of emergencies. Preparedness is essential to keep families safe and promote health and well-being in unexpected situations. Of course, COVID-19 has elevated the importance of this topic, and we have a lot to learn about what is going well and what we can do better in the future. We talked to our MCH friends in Tennessee about their COVID-19 journey.
Hi, my name is Dr. Toby Amison. I am the Assistant Commissioner for the Tennessee Department of Health and the Title V Director, as well as the Director of the Division of Family Health and Wellness.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Johnson. I am the Title V Children, Youth, and Special Healthcare Needs Director for the state of Tennessee.
We asked our guests what their Emergency Preparedness and Response Efforts, or EPR, looked like before the COVID-19 pandemic. Jacqueline told us that their Division of Family Health and Wellness sits on a statewide emergency preparedness team and participated in annual updates of the continuity plan, affectionately referred to as the co-op plan.
That plan was mainly to help programs to determine the essential functions necessary to, in case of emergencies, and identify the resources and recovery time that's required to complete those functions. So for children, youth, and special healthcare needs, this included systems necessary for approval of medical treatment and services, reimbursement for those services, and the persons responsible for being there to make those services happen. So while we had always participated in the disaster response and efforts prior to March 2020, the program had not necessarily considered the guidelines and procedures in place for program participation and family participation and how that affected those individuals and families serve. So we were prepared to bring our data systems up for within 12 to 48 hours, depending on the program. We could approve medical treatment, and we could actually respond to natural disasters, you know, within a 12 to 24 hour time frame.
So what was it like for the agency when faced with an unprecedented pandemic and public health emergency in early 2020?
March of 2020 was unique in that the state experienced tornadoes right before Tennessee's first COVID case was announced. I just want to go on to say that there were many challenges initially in our response to the pandemic, and not initially having equipment, testing supplies, and data infrastructure in place. It was just a little unsettling, I would say, for at the least. And there was also a big shift for the department for employees to work from home. We had not been an agency that had broad work from home initiatives going on. In most places, equipment was not there for employees, broadband was not there, and Wi-Fi was somewhat non-existent in our rural areas. While our EP section was able to put plans in place relatively quickly in the state, but from an individual program perspective, we were really good with getting our systems back up if necessary and following other aspects of our COOP plan. We realized relatively quick that systems-based response was not necessarily what our staff or our families that we serve needed in order to be able to move forward in the pandemic. Our care coordinate initiative in some areas was not included in the COOP plan. Tennessee had integrated three programs in 2018 to develop a care coordination model that's unique to the state of Tennessee. The CYSHCN section was included. However, those areas were created to assist families with assessing and navigating resources and services other than medical were not in the plan. This included the need for us to develop an individual continuity plan for the CHANT services. At that time, it was an in-person care coordination plan that was paper-based. Application, charting, documentation, food, formula, pharmaceutical services, everything we did was pretty much from a paper perspective. And so not being able to be in the office, have access to that paper, created some significant challenges. And we had to create partners really quickly with our providers, with our formula, food and formula providers, with drop shipping food and formula to homes, as well as local health departments, pharmacy providers, trying to work with them to provide 90-day supplies versus 30-day supplies. It became a real reality relatively quickly that we were not equipped actually to deal with some of the challenges that we faced in 2020.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. I heard that you touched on the experiences that you all had with overlapping emergencies and also how the pandemic kind of sped up or brought you all to more of a virtual workspace that you weren't initially prepared for. And I think that those are important things to consider when talking about emergency preparedness and response. And I know that you also touched on some of the challenges that you all faced as a result of where you were before you moved into responding to the pandemic. Dr. Emerson, is there anything that you would add about the challenges that you all had and any successes that you all had related to your EPR efforts since then?
Sure. So Jackie had already referenced the tornadoes that came through the very beginning of March. And so I feel like that was really the beginning of the beginning of the end for us, almost on the biblical proportion. But Tennessee had had some unique challenges. We had EF4 tornadoes come through Middle Tennessee, March 2020. In addition to that, we had several other natural and man-made disasters happen over the course of 2020 and 2021. Obviously, we went into lockdown just like the rest of the country did during 2020, but we also had a major Christmas Day bombing that destroyed our newborn screening services laboratory. We also had some significant flooding in the western part of the state during 2021 and then tornadoes again last year. Those are some of the biggest challenges that we've faced. So in addition to all the challenges of COVID, we've really faced some just infrastructure challenges. And you don't think about it, but all of those plans that you make in making sure you have a backup lab, making sure you have backup generators, making sure you have go kits for your WIC program, for your children, youth, and special health care needs programs, those really came into play during while we were dealing with all of those natural and man-made disasters. Other challenges are specific to Tennessee, and I think anywhere that has a lot of rural areas, broadband access has been really difficult for us in Tennessee. There are certain spots in West Tennessee as well as East Tennessee that have difficult access to internet. I think for a lot of people, the switch to this virtual environment, while it has created some unique challenges, some of the successes that we've had has been the increase in telehealth and telework overall across our state. It's been able to increase our access and representation. So very often if we're having committee meetings, whatever it might be, being able to get broad representation from all across the state has been really great.
We developed an emergency preparedness toolkit with Tennessee facing many, many tornadoes a year and floods and all those things. It's necessary that our families have those items that they need for FEMA and all the other processes they have to go through when they're affected. So one of the biggest things that we're proud of is our emergency decal and magnet, which is a decal that families can place on the windows or front doors, as well as the magnet they can put on their car. They have an information card that actually provides emergency personnel with detailed information if there's a child with special health care needs, what common methods they may use, what other kinds of implements or material that may be necessary for that child in the emergency situation to lessen the burdens on our families.
All right. Thank you so much for that response. And we've witnessed how COVID-19 disproportionately impacts communities of color. Black American, Latino, and Indigenous people have experienced higher rates of infection, death, and other negative impacts due to systemic inequities. For example, housing inequity, reliance on public transportation, being deemed an essential worker, just to name a few. How has your agency intentionally centered Black and other communities of color in your COVID-19 response efforts?
When you look at Tennessee's vaccine rollout, we were very, very intentional in terms of how we structured not just access to care from a rural standpoint, but also people disproportionately for people of color. So when you look at how we calculated where to send vaccines, we used a social vulnerability index from the CDC as a way for us to make sure that we were getting vaccines to the priority locations. And one of the other things that our Office of Health Disparities Elimination has been working really well on has been getting stories of people who've been personally affected by COVID-19 out there. They have PSAs that are really well done and really compelling. And it's sort of having a person talk to a person, because we found that those individual stories have been the most effective in terms of changing people's opinion about COVID vaccination. The other thing that we've been doing, and we've never really stopped doing, is just continuing to reach out to community partners. We've hired a Hispanic engagement coordinator in Tennessee Department of Health. We also have a health equity liaison physician who's been really instrumental in helping us get a lot of our priorities aligned, so that way that our messaging is consistent across the state.
What has Tennessee learned from the past 2 years of constant emergency response efforts?
Using individuals that were from the same community to speak to those to people around the pandemic and what was happening and the need to get tested and the need for vaccinations, as you said, really helped with our being able to meet this crisis.
They told me their advice for others is to continue moving services to virtual environments, be open to adapting to change quickly, and working with new and non-traditional partners, and look at everything with an equity lens. Sounds like a pretty great path forward for all of us. At AmChip, we have the pleasure of getting to work with maternal and child health professionals in all 59 states and jurisdictions. So to say that every public health agency is unique is an understatement. After talking with our partners in Tennessee, I sat down with a colleague from Puerto Rico to see what emergency preparedness and response looks like for them.
Hello, I'm Camille Delgado. I'm an epidemiologist and the surveillance coordinator for the Surveillance of Emerging Threats to Mothers and Babies, previously known as the SICA Active Pregnancy Surveillance System. And we are one of the programs within the Children with Special Medical Needs Division in the Puerto Rico Department of Health.
Camille mentioned the Zika epidemic. Remember that? The Zika virus spreads by the bite of an infected mosquito. In 2015 and 2016, the Zika virus was a major problem for MCH populations, especially pregnant people, since we learned the virus can cause certain birth defects. Puerto Rico was especially hard hit by the epidemic.
Well, Puerto Rico was the first U.S. territory to report local transmission of the Zika virus. Warmer climates definitely may have facilitated the expansion of the geographic range of mosquito populations and potentially increased their capacity to transmit the Zika virus. Puerto Rico is an archipelago that is located in the Caribbean with a climate that is perfect and suitable for mosquito species. Zika is spread mainly by the Aedes mosquitoes, which are endemic in Puerto Rico. As we know, Puerto Rico took it very seriously because the Zika was a public health emergency because it can be transmitted from mother to fetus during pregnancy, and it has been linked to increasing miscarriages, death in newborns, birth defects, neurodevelopmental abnormalities have become apparent during the first months and years of life. Then, as soon as the first case was reported, the Puerto Rico Secretary of Health passed administrative orders, declared a state of emergency in the island, and they required the report of any case to the Puerto Rico Department of Health. Another one mandated the report of pregnant women with laboratory evidence of Zika to the Puerto Rico Department of Health, and the Zika Active Pregnancy Surveillance System was established, SAPS in short, in collaboration with the CDC, the Division and the Epidemiology Office of the Puerto Rico Department of Health. And through all of these administrative orders, partnerships, and collaborations allowed SAPS a rapid ascertainment and identification of pregnant women with Zika infection. Another part was that SAPS was also part of the Puerto Rico Emergency Operations Center, and that ensured that pregnant women and their children were a priority in the emergency response in many aspects. Within the division, the planning for the emergency started before a Zika case was identified in the island. And that allowed the surveillance of pregnant women to start fairly quickly after the first case was identified. And another aspect of how the Zika epidemic changed emergency preparedness efforts for the MCH population, in my opinion, is that our direct involvement allowed us to create these partnerships that we have maintained in all of the emergencies that followed the Zika epidemic.
After the Zika epidemic, Puerto Rico faced two other significant climate change related emergencies when it was hit with back-to-back hurricanes Irma and Maria in September 2017. Could you share a little about Puerto Rico's Department of Health emergency preparedness efforts, especially as it was still dealing with the Zika epidemic? What were some of the challenges and the impacts of having to respond to intersecting and overlapping emergencies on pregnant people and technology-dependent infants, children, and youth?
So Puerto Rico is particularly vulnerable to climate-related emergencies since it's an island and we see rising sea levels from climate change and stronger storms. Puerto Rico throughout its history has experienced devastating hurricanes, but now we have seen an increase in intensity and occurrence due to climate change and rising global temperatures. The timing of Hurricane Maria was particularly damaging because Puerto Ricans were still recovering from the damage caused by Hurricane Irma, and we were still without power and water and just starting to rebuild when Hurricane Maria hit. Just to give you some data, 100% of residents were without electricity, 60% were without drinking water, and 92% of the telecommunications towers were also down. The power outage in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria remains the largest power outage in the United States history.
Can you imagine? No electricity, no safe drinking water, and no way to communicate with others? This extreme emergency definitely put the public health system to the test. I asked Camille to tell me about what the response in rebuilding looked like for their MCH program.
I remember we started working just 1 week after Hurricane Maria hit. We were sharing spaces and getting back to work in this new scenario, which to say was complicated is an understatement. We had no communication and no power. Our priority populations, I remember, were infants, children, and youth with inborn errors of metabolism, infants born with mothers with Zika infection during pregnancy, the technology-dependent infants, children, and youth, and the children and youth with autism spectrum disorder. The families that were being monitored by SAPS, many were experiencing worry and anxiety that there was going to be a disruption in healthcare since 16 days after the hurricane, only 25 of the 78 hospitals were working. While they were experiencing these worries, they were also living without power and food and water. The most important thing was to contact them, make sure they were safe, and if they needed something, for us to help facilitate or be liaisons. We had service coordinators, family engagement, support staff, and direct services teams that attempted to locate families in the field using their last known addresses. The other population that was in desperate need of help after the hurricanes was the infant, children, and youth dependent of life-maintaining technology. Before the hurricanes, a centralized registry didn't exist. During and after the hurricanes, these children were going to the hospital, but not as patients, but as refugees. Access to the generators and failure of the generators they had was one of the main challenges for these families. Many of the families made the decision to leave Puerto Rico, but that also brought new challenges. The process of identifying and getting the necessary equipment for these patients to travel, all the clearances needed. Then when they arrived at their destinations, ensuring that their medical plan covered outside of Puerto Rico the health services they need was another challenge. Seeing all of this, the division created a registry. And right after the hurricane, the registry was able to identify and collect the needs of this population and later served as a liaison between families, agencies, and foundations that were available to aid and ensure that these families received the services or equipment that they needed. The registry also helped in the process when families decided to move out of the island. The main challenge throughout the programs in the division was contacting the families because all of the telecommunications were down. The way that we worked to attend the overlapping emergencies was that all the different programs concentrated on their population of interest. Of course, assisting and helping other programs if needed, but that way, all the monitor populations within the division had a team just for them.
Thank you so much for that. It sounds like a lot of learning happened in real time. You all were learning the things that needed to happen and making those adjustments so that you could respond in real time. And that's a very unique skill. Can you tell our listeners how Puerto Rico switched gears from Zika response and hurricane response to COVID-19 response? What were some lessons learned or strategies from past emergencies that you all used to pivot to address COVID-19?
We used the infrastructure that we had for Zika, all of our collaborative agreements and partners. We just updated them. Like, for example, with the Puerto Rico Vital Signs and the Puerto Rico Medicaid Administration, we informed them and updated all our collaborative agreement with them and informed them that we were going to include COVID-19 pregnant cases to our surveillance. And all of the data that they got from the COVID-19, we have also. So that was a huge thing that we kept using. And in Puerto Rico, our data is currently being used to see if new or more influential infection prevention and vaccination strategies are needed to further protect pregnant women. My advice would be to document in detail the problem or the emergency, its effects in the MCH population, and have ideas on how to manage it. And if you're thinking of preparedness, just making a plan for preparedness, you can take examples of places that are experiencing or have experienced the same impact of what you want to address and bring all that documentation to key stakeholders and personnel within your organization that can help make a change. Partnerships and collaborations are essential, and you will find that programs and organizations outside the Department of Health do want to help, and you will find help with outside programs.
Great. Is there anything else that you want to share with us today?
If you have the power connections to make sure that the MCH population is included and it's a priority when a real disaster or public health emergency occurs, no one will forget about these vulnerable populations. There will be times that you and your program will not be able to maybe offer some services or help directly, but it's also important to identify and collect and document the needs that the population is seeing and serve as a liaison between these families and agencies or foundations that do have available those services and ensure that these families receive the services they need.
Puerto Rico's experience really drives home the importance of being prepared for emergencies, engaging with community partners, and making sure that the unique needs of MCH populations are considered. Thank you so much to our guests from Tennessee and Puerto Rico for sharing their experiences with us in helping to prioritize MCH populations during public health emergencies.
Thank you all for joining us for this episode of MCH Bridges. We kindly ask that you take a few minutes to fill out a quick feedback survey and let us know what MCH-related topics you're interested in and who you want to hear from on future episodes. A link to the podcast feedback survey, as well as a transcript of this episode, can be found at www.mchbridges.org. Be sure to follow AmCHIP on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at @DC_AMCHP. We hope this episode created some new connections for you. Stay well, and I hope our paths cross on the next MCH Bridges. This project is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, as part of an award totaling $1,963,039 with 0% financed with non-governmental sources. This information or content and conclusions are those of the author and should not be construed as the official position or policy of, nor should any endorsements be inferred by HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government.